Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is host Richard Benulli. Today is May 21st. We have Joseph Wang and Ira Harris and Judd Hirschberg. Joseph is known as the Fed guy, having worked as a senior trader on the open markets desk at the Federal Reserve. And Ira is an independent trader, past hedge fund manager, global macro consultant trading foreign currencies, equities, bonds, and commodities for over 40 years. He was also CME director from 1997 to 2003, and a stint most recently. And also we have Judd Hirschberg of White Wave Trading Strategies joining us to provide technical charts relating to specific asset classes being discussed. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for inviting me.
Great. I thought we'd begin, Joseph, with your view on the global macro of the economy and the financial markets.
You know, right now, I think it's really an interesting time to be in the markets and really to be just alive. You know, I think we're at a cusp of big changes in how the world works. And it's starting from the U.S. The U.S. is changing its business model in a fundamental way. I think for the past few decades, what would happen is that, you know, we would spend a whole lot of money and we would spend it on goods that people produced outside of the country. They would give us stuff and we would give them pieces of paper and that made them happy. And, you know, it sounds like we have a good thing going, but that also has some political implications, right? So I think one of the things that the current administration has been talking about is that it has security concerns. Basically, we're asking other people to make stuff for us. But then if we were to fight a war or if we were to have some kind of emergency, we'd be relying on others. And furthermore, basically, other people are doing our homework for us. And that means that we're not learning how to do all this engineering, how to do all these advanced sciences as well as we could. And so it seems like there's a concern about technological leadership as well. So there's a national security and growth aspect, but also a very real political concern in that if you look at a graph of the labor force participation rate of men who don't have a college degree, it's really plummeted. And I'm talking about prime age men. It's plummeted, you know, I think about 10% since it was a few decades ago. So there's a lot of people who are not doing well, who kind of feel left out. And I think that this globalization thing impacted them as well. And to be clear, this is pretty common across the developed world. You see the same thing happening in other advanced economies as well. So, the politics are that they want to change this entire system. So that's done through rebalancing the global trade system. And also, I think the administration also aspired to balancing the fiscal situation as well, but it doesn't seem to be very successful in that side. Now, I think this rebalancing of the global economic model that they're doing is what's shaping all the asset prices right now and what's going to shape the economic growth in going forward, because it's not just disruptive for the US. I mean, you have to think about all the other countries who built their economic model on selling to the US. And that's not just China, that's countries like like Germany as well. So there's a lot of disruption both within and outside of the US. Now, from an asset perspective, I think what I find to be most troubling is that, you know, at the end of the day, when we buy stuff from other people, other countries, say China, for example, they don't actually spend that money. If they did, we wouldn't have a huge trade deficit with them, right? We would be trading, we'd buy from them and they'd buy from us. At the end of the day, other countries tend to save the proceeds of their trade, and they basically buy U.S. assets. And if we are disrupting the trade side of this, and so, you know, that suggests that there's going to be less demand for U.S. assets going forward. And not to mention, there are also many other things that I think that are being done to make the U.S., I guess, be perceived to be not as reliable or not as a good destination of capital as before. And again, initial conditions matter. I think the foreign investors were also very highly exposed to U.S. coming into the Liberation Day, and we can talk all about that. There's a lot of data on that. So that's one thing there that I think on a structural aspect is not good for U.S. assets. The second thing, of course, is that the administration seems to have trouble delivering on fixing the fiscal deficit, and that suggests a significant supply of treasuries to come, not just, let's say, far off into the future, but looking at the structure of the upcoming big, beautiful bill, it's very, very weighted towards the first couple years. And so it's going to increase treasury issuance by a few hundred billion next year and the year after that. The way that these bills are written, they're very clever. So again, you don't want to have a huge fiscal deficit headline number. And so you write provisions and have them to expire in a few years. The way this bill is written is that you have a whole bunch of tax cuts that expire basically right after the 2028 election. So it's going to be a front-loaded stimulus bill. And odds are, if they are like the other bills we've seen in the past, the 2029 Congress will just renew it as well. So we're at a point where, you know, we're issuing a whole bunch of U.S. assets, and at the same time, we are changing the world in a way that foreigners may not be as interested in U.S. assets. So when I'm looking at the market pricing, what I see is yields up, equities down, dollar down, and that's classic signs of some degree of capital flight. We saw a hint of that in April when we had that really interesting post-Liberation Day price action where we had the dollar selling off a lot and yields rising a lot. That's not typical, right? You would think of the U.S. as a safe haven destination, but that seems to be changing a little bit. And I mean, there are macro forces and political forces that suggest that makes sense. So we're at a place, I think, where the future will not look like the past. And it's a very interesting and very dangerous time.
Yeah, those are great points. And you actually got into my second question too, in a capital flight indication with U.S. bonds down, U.S. equities down, and U.S. dollar down, happening at least earlier today and yesterday in the last several weeks generally. So that's interesting. Your thoughts, Ira?
Well, I mean, we'll get into the meat of this. Yes, those are certainly all worthwhile topics, especially I'm still amazed that people really wanted to extend out their duration anyway. And yes, I have a lot of respect for Scott Bessent, and I know that he came in writing that really what he was focused on was the 10-year. But I will say this, he disappointed me over the weekend, because late Friday, of course, when Moody's woke up from a 14-year hiatus of the S&P and decided, well, we're going to downgrade. It's such nonsense that it took him so long, but we'll have that part of the discussion also. But Bessent could have run with that and said, look, this is just the beginning. Rather than saying it's a lagging indicator, yeah, we know it's 14 years lagging. And it shocked me, because he could have said, this is what's going to be taking place unless you really get at what's going on here. And this morning, the 40,000 cap, I think, is nonsense. I don't think it should be moved, and it affects me. But, you know, if you're going to tax the wealthier, why would you leave it? I know the politics of it. I'm not naive. I understand the politics of it. But if you're going to be serious about deficits and their impact upon the cost of your financing those deficits, then let's get down to business. All right. The Democrats are just as remiss for not going after the defense budget, because when Musk came in, they were screaming about the defense budget. Now you just had Steve Bannon on an interview with NPR of all places screaming about the defense budget. Why aren't people? Because you better get serious, because the cost of this is going to, and the market is going to make you pay for it. You know, whether it's an outflow of capital, we'll see. What it's going to do is break the back of the carry trade, which that doesn't bother me at all, because to me, the carry trade is a very temporal fundamental. It only lasts for so long, because really it's almost third world, global south-ish, because if you have to pay more for capital, it's not a healthy thing. Yes, you can get away with it as the United States and maybe a couple others for a short period of time, but people eventually wake up and go, this is a weakness. This is not a strength. And And now I see people writing today about, well, you know, people shouldn't be extending their out the duration. No, really? And you can see it here. I'm sitting here looking right now in my Bloomberg sheet this morning at where all the yield curves are on a global basis. And the United States is still, for the most part, the most flat curve of all the majors, right? So it's got room to run, but why would you extend out, especially with the buffoonery of Republicans and Democrats in Congress? Why would you extend out your exposure to U.S. debt? I know you have obligations, you have time matches, but it doesn't really make any sense to me, and it hasn't made any sense to me. So we'll go from there. But I certainly relish, because Joseph is the right person to talk about this to, you know, when it comes to monitoring this. Outside of James Aiken or Zoltan Pozar, there's nobody I'd rather be talking to right now. And that's, and I'll tell you, Joe, that's rarefied air. So I put you in that category. So yeah. Let's go at it.
All right, so that's a high bar. Those are both two greats in the field. So hopefully I won't be too disappointing. No, I totally agree with you with this. I think Yuri makes a really good point. It's really that there hasn't been a forcing mechanism, that people just keep doing this over and over again, because the only thing that it seems the politicians really care about is the market. And we saw that in April, right? Now, President Trump had this vision of reshaping global trade. It's something that he's dreamed of for decades. And so, you know, he talked tough game. He said, you know, markets are just so rich people, right? And we're trying to do things for Main Street. But at the end of the day, I think the pressure was too large, both because of the bond market and the equity market. And so he had to pivot a bit. And I think the same thing is the only thing that will change the spending situation in the U.S., right? So unless we really do have, I guess, this quasi emerging market price action where higher spending means a weaker currency, higher yields, and lower equity markets, we're really not going to have any control over the spending situation. Now, the thing is, it's really hard to know just when that point is. Like what I think about, for example, is we have two really clear examples. Now, recently we had Germany going, doing a lot more spending on infrastructure and rearming it. Tremendous amounts of spending there leads to a strong euro, leads to booming markets, right? And that's because everyone perceives that to be very growth positive and thinks that Germany is going to be fine, right? They're going to get their spending under control. And to be clear, debt to GDP ratio for Germany is much, much lower than it is for most peer countries. But if you go back a couple of years, you also have the situation in the UK, which of course, I mean, the UK, looking at these conventional metrics, is not great, but not terrible either. But just basically out of nowhere, you had that Liz Truss movement where the markets made a judgment, and there were some technical things happening in the markets as well. As we know, there's that LDI issue, and that seemed to shape market perception such that the market, at least some people, began to think that, you know, this UK debt situation is not sustainable. And for the 2 years after that, since now, I think the government there has paid more attention to their budget, and the market has as well. So you had that one moment that seemed to change perceptions. Now for the US, again, we are the reserve currency, great power and so forth. So everyone gives us a lot of credit, and no one really knows how much money how sustainable the US fiscal trajectory is. But if you look at what we're spending right now, 7% of GDP, and projected to continue that, plus on top of the big, beautiful bill, plus, I think, and this is most important to me, what happened in April, where we had a moment for a few days where it seemed like the U.S. was losing some of its safe haven status. I think that together sends us a warning signal that, you know, that limit is closer than we think. And certainly the price action today as the market begins to focus on the fiscal spending, suggests that as well. So this is something, I mean, it's not a science or no hard rules to that. A lot of this is perception, judgments by what the politics and the trajectory is. And, you know, it's not looking like it's a good place. So I think it's a really interesting situation here. And ultimately, if we do have some kind of, you know, event in the market because of this, I think that's a good thing, because ultimately that's the forcing mechanism that gets us back on track to focus more on having a sustainable, a better fiscal situation.
And on the capital flight indicators that we discussed earlier, do you have insight or able to drill down in terms of what's happening there, like who is selling U.S. Treasury bonds or maybe equities?
So when I look at the capital flight situation, there's two things I want to mention. So at the end of the day, market pricing is just, you know, supply and demand, right? Now, the problem is that going into Liberation Day, foreigners were heavily exposed to U.S. assets, and we know they love treasuries, but they also really loved U.S. equities as well. We were home to the Mag 7, NVIDIA, AI, and all that stuff. So there's a tremendous exposure here. Now, as the dollar weakened, it seems like that's causing and asset prices declined. That was a big problem for a lot of the foreign investors. They were down on their assets. They were down on their dollar as well. It's a complete reversal of the great long U.S. trade they had over the past few years. And even worse, there was the possibility that in a risk-off episode, that dollar wouldn't appreciate and wouldn't provide that hedge. So you have a situation where, because of all these changes and because of initial positioning as a foreign investor, you have to adjust a little bit, right? It doesn't mean that you're fleeing the U.S., but I think it does mean you have to rebalance a bit. And there's a lot of stories in the news of investors having to do just that. If you look at the equity holdings for Norway's sovereign wealth fund, for example, it's all public. All the largest equity holdings are Mag 7 funds. So this is a global trade that just needs to be rebalanced a bit. Now, I think the big problem, though, now, is that one, there's a lot to rebalance. But two, just looking at the policy going forward, if you want to rebalance global trade and you've kind of maxed out your tariffs already, and I don't think they want to do another Liberation Day, the other policy is currency policy. And I think that's going to come into play, not necessarily in Euroland, I think, but very obviously in East Asia. Now, that's a problem because, again, when you're going to depreciate your currency, foreign investors are going to lose money on that. That's basically telling foreign investors, hi, you're going to lose some money. To benefit U.S. exporters. And I think this administration has been very, very willing to let foreigners pay. Now, this is a particular problem for countries like Taiwan, for South Korea, for Japan, which have tremendous trade surpluses with the U.S. and currencies that are historically weak against the dollar. So over the past few weeks, we've seen the Taiwan dollar, for example, appreciate significantly against the U.S. dollar, seemingly out of nowhere. Taiwan is a country that has a historically, whose currency is trading at a historically weak exchange rate against the U.S. and has over time accumulated over $1 trillion of U.S. assets and runs a trade surplus that is, you know, let's say over 10% of GDP. So there are countries like that that own a lot of U.S. assets and are at risk of being subject to some kind of currency accord that would make their currencies appreciate and thus their investors lose. So I think people have to, you know, be aware of that and try to get out of dollars assets ahead of it. And so that could, I think it's a good reason for people to be selling right now. Now, we won't know exactly who's been selling until we get the TIC data in a couple months, but again, looking at the news reports, it seems like a wide range of people. And in particular, there's very good reason for East Asian investors to be reducing their dollar exposure.
And just a quick follow-up question on that, Joseph, in terms of these appreciation of East Asian currencies, do you see that as a result of the asset selling or maybe as a part of tariff negotiations happening in the background for an agreement on currency appreciation, a de facto Plaza Accord 2, if you will?
So just to start with the economic fundamentals, the dollar is historically quite strong against those currencies. So that's one thing. That's a starting point. The second point is that these countries have tremendous trade surpluses with the U.S. So these two don't really, I think from the administration's perspective, don't make sense. And lastly, the administration, the United States, has tremendous influence over many of these Asian countries. Taiwan, for example, exists because the U.S. is willing to protect them. And the U.S., of course, does a whole lot in protecting Korea and Japan as well. And they have always been very good allies. So you have, I guess, leverage over them. And so looking across this relationship, it makes sense that there would be a currency component. the economics make sense of it, and also that they would be willing to do it simply because of the other relationships, the long-standing multidimensional relationships the U.S. has with them. So I think that's a, you know, a good chance of happening. And I think there's some news that this is one of the things being discussed. After all, the president has noted for many, many, many years that these guys, they manipulate their currency, they are taking advantage of us and so forth. And I believe Secretary Bessin has also suggested currency as one of the things to talk about. So they've been focusing a lot on non-tariff trade barriers. So this is one of them. Don't know if it will actually happen, but the market, of course, is anticipating this. And that's why you see the Taiwan dollar appreciate by, you know, almost 10% over a few days. So that's going to have a big impact for, say, East Asian investors holding U.S. assets. And I think if I were them, I'd have to be wary of that and try to reduce my exposure.
Mm-hmm. And Ira, what are your thoughts on this East Asia currency appreciation and the driver? Is it tariff discussions? Your thoughts?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of moving parts to this, and Joseph covered it pretty well. The Taiwan, the Sing dollar is really interesting to me for reasons because of their desire to be a financial center. But the question is, as they're appreciating the Korean, will they allow the yen to sit here? And I mean, will they? It's a question. Because don't forget, you know, everybody says, well, they can't intervene. That's such pure nonsense. The United States has intervened to strengthen the yen June 1998 under Bob Rubin in the Treasury. It's not the Fed, but it was Bill Clinton's on his way to Beijing. The Chinese were complaining about the weakness of the yen. Boom. And it's interesting the levels we were at. I think we had gotten up to 147, or we did afterwards, but we were in the same area. But the Chinese were very upset about the weakness of the yen, and the Fed did intervene. Now, the intervention didn't last long, and the dollar started going right back again because the carry trade was in vogue, and there was a lot of reasons to be negative the yen. And just, you know, very rarely does intervention work unless the currency is really ready to go anyway. So that may be what's going on in Taiwan. But going back to the Monetary Authority of Singapore, who was one of the most effective players in intervening in the currency markets, and I go back a lot of years, Philip Toh was running the Monetary Authority of Singapore. So they know when they want to move, and they're sitting there, and they're helping push us. But there's a lot of those currencies because the interest rates have been low. And for other reasons that, you know, they had the help of the world in keeping their currencies on the soft side. So will this work? I'm one who thinks that it can, because I think the only fundamental to me driving the U.S. dollar in a positive fashion was the carry trade. The interest rate differential favored the U.S. But again, I'll say it again, interest rate differentials are a very flawed fundamental. Yes, they work because, yeah, I'm going to earn a little bit more. And yes, but overall, if you're not taking that window of opportunity to improve your situation, then it's going to become naught, and all you're going to do is pay more money, meaning the U.S. And they're paying, and we're hemorrhaging out interest payments on the U.S. deficit. And, you know, it's interesting. You know, Ishiba, the Prime Minister of Japan, the National Enquirer of Financial News, Zero Hedge, ran with it the other day, that he compared Japan to Greece. Well, when you went and looked at the context, that was not quite the headline. That's why I call him the National Enquirer, because it was far more than that. Because Ishiba was trying to beat back those who were looking to cut the consumer tax. And he was worried more about what it would do to the overall budget deficit. Now today we get another piece out talking about, and I think it was from Ishiba, talking about the need to run a primary surplus in the deficit. Now that's an interesting, because that's what Greece did, by the way. But Greece did it through an internal devaluation, if we remember, and they they removed the prime minister, meaning the EU did, in order to get the right person in there. It drove certain people so crazy. Who I love, the Greek, who was the finance minister.
Varoufakis,
I think he's, okay. I don't always agree with him, but he's always interesting. So certain things had to take place. Is Japan in that situation? I say absolutely not. First of all, because their debt is owned so much domestically, which makes it far different than most other places, especially the United States, who depends on the kindness of strangers, to quote Blanche DuBois in Streetcar Named Desire. So the United States really does depend on the kind, as others depend on us for defense, of course. There's a symbiotic relationship that's allowed to exist. But there are all these things going on. And see, I think Japan's made a major mistake, because Ueda, following what I call the MIT scenario, which is where they all get together and they discuss, Japan should have been at, overnight rates in Japan should be at 1.5% already. First of all, it would have strengthened the yen, and they could have used a market to do it, where the BOJ would never have had to intervene, because as the carry trade become in line, it would just put a floor under the yen, and it would have been, and as I argued with somebody I know who's an expert on Japan, I said, the market's going to do it for you anyway. And that's exactly what's going on. Where's the 10? So we're at 150, 150 basis points on the Japanese, on the JGB, the 10-year. And we know what happened with the 40-year, it's over 3%. So the market's doing it. You may as well do it, because the market's going to punish you for not doing it. And it would have changed the structure. Now, I think that under Yellen and Brainard, I think they talked the Japanese into not being as aggressive. This is just my conjecture, because they were afraid that if the Japanese started, and they said it, if they started raising rates too aggressively, then it would have disrupted the whole sovereign debt market around the world. And that certainly would have, and it would have made their job that much tougher, because the 10-year was struggling enough, but they were afraid that would have disrupted the entire thing. Well, again, you can only hide for so long, and we're back here. And so I talk about it in that regard. So Joseph, if I can, so we talked about the debt situation, but I thought when Bessent came in up until April 2nd, I thought he would have favored a failed auction so that he could get the deficit and really get people to focus, because they're not focusing. And even his comments about it, they're not focusing. They're not. And we see, whatever they want to call this nonsense and the raising of the salt, but they could have done this much better. And had he had a failed auction, whether the Fed would have allowed or not, I don't know. That's your call, Joseph, far better than my own. But it would have kicked everybody in the teeth and woken them up, going, the game is over. Now you got to get to work and roll up your sleeves. And I know, and the politics are bad, because Powell could actually help here a little bit. I thought the Fed should have cut rates. And I want to hear your, just because everybody else in the world is cutting rates. The ECB is now cutting every meeting. The Brits cut. The Aussies just cut. And they talked about cutting an extra 25 basis point. Everybody's in a cutting mode. Everybody's in a cutting mode. So I'm going to wait. I think it would have, satisfied and done certain things better.
Meet the Cedar Owl, a new economics and finance publication with a focus on environmentalism. We combine the Austrian School of Economics and market environmentalism principles for investing in a sustainable future. Follow the link in the description to get to know the Cedar Owl better, understand our values, our mission, exactly where we're coming from, and the type of content that we release on a cyclical basis every Thursday. Join us in targeting outperforming portfolio returns while making a positive impact on society and the environment through technology. Subscribe now for weekly insights, investment articles, and exclusive content.
Okay. Go ahead, Joseph.
Well, yeah, first off, I agree with you. Yeah. I think that the only way that we're going to have, I think, fiscal policy that's not just endlessly expansionary is that there has to be a political price for that. And that has to be done through the market. There's no other way. So I think that's kind of what we learned over the, that's what I learned over the past few weeks. So looking at the market, you know, we have the dollar selling off, we have yields rising. So we're eventually going to get there. So I think eventually the market will force the Congress's hand. So we'll see how that goes. Now about the Fed cutting rates. So I actually do think the Fed should be cutting rates. Now, I remember last year, the Fed cut rates preemptively by 50 basis points when growth was very good, when, you know, stock market was at all-time highs and so forth, because they were looking at the data and they wanted to get ahead of the weakness, afraid that, you know, we might be going to recession. They wanted to be preemptive. So that's kind of how they act. And I think that's a responsible way to act. But then it seems less clear today what they're doing. Now, Chair Powell today is basically committing to being late, right? He says that, yeah, we have all these big changes in the world. I don't really know what's going to happen. So I want to wait to see what the data says before I act. Now, the thing is, when you see the data, when you already have high unemployment rate, or when you already see lots of poor growth, it's kind of too late though. So they don't want to be preemptive anymore. They're committed to being late, saying that because there's just so many changes in the world. You know, I don't know if that's a good look, because yes, there are big changes in the world, but it's also clear that looking at measures of consumer sentiment, looking at the labor market, that things are definitely softening, right? Equity markets have also declined a lot. They've regained, rebounced, but still off their highs and so forth. So it does seem to me that there is a reasonable way to think about it would be to have some kind of cut, if only because the data really has been softening. Now, they seem to be concerned about inflation, in particular inflation expectations, because when you look at some of the consumer surveys, some portion of the public is really concerned about inflation. Now, that is, we don't want the public to be panicked about inflation, but the actual inflation data, you know, has been trending to the downside, right? And also, you also have things like energy prices that have come down a lot. So it doesn't really seem like inflation is trending higher, right? If you have a weaker economy, wages are coming down, unemployment is going up. Most of what's in the inflation index is services oriented. So it doesn't seem like inflation is trending up, but it does seem like growth is trending lower. So it makes sense. I personally think it makes sense for there to be cuts. Now, looking at market pricing, it seems like the market pricing is following the equity market a lot. When equities go up, they price out cuts. When equities go down, they price in cuts. Now, my own view is that we'll probably have more declines in the equity markets going forward, and that will, along with the slowing data, again, if you do the math on the tariffs, before Liberation Day, the U.S. imported about $3 trillion of goods. The volume weighted tariff rate for that was about 3%. Now we're going up to 10% minimum. On top of that, you have other tariffs as well. So the tariff rate is going up a lot. And that's not, you know, again, we're not a very import dependent economy. But oftentimes, if you look at what happened in 2018, that just cuts off, you know, profits for companies, because they eat a lot of it. So you're going to have lower corporate profits. That's going to impact hiring and so forth. So seems like as the economy weakens, as the equity markets decline, I think we'd get more cuts. Market would become, my own guess is at least 100 basis points more in easing this year.
What do you think, Ira? Will there be cuts? You're on mute, Ira. Mute, yeah.
I can't agree with him more. Yeah. And I think that, you know, and I listen to, who I like, Beth Hammack, who's to me a nice voice because she truly understands markets. She's been a little cold with it, but I think that there's more stress in the financial system, and as foreign bonds head the other way, not just U.S. but I mean U.S. banks are sitting on, you know, massive amounts of hold to maturities, you know, that they bought when they were kind of forced into it. And we saw what happened in 2023 with First Republic. First Republic, especially even more than Silicon Valley, was a huge surprise because it was such a darling of of the financial investment world. And it just, you know, as I tell people, it dropped from $160 down to zero. You know, and I think there's more of these out there. You know, we know the private credit markets, the private equity market. There's a lot of risk there. And I think, and because Trump can't stop himself from talking, he forces Powell to dig his heels in. And that's not a good place to be. And everybody is following that. And you know what? And on a relative basis, again, the United States real yields are probably the highest of anybody. Because, you know, I would probably say the real yield in Europe is zero. And that makes perfect sense because they're now that the Schwarzenau is gone and the Germany has this room and they're going to expand their financial stimulus, it's a good place to be at zero real yields until you get the growth and then real yields will go positive again. But I think relative to where the U.S. is, and it's interesting. So I'm coming back to Joseph, we haven't heard them talk about our star of late. And what is their level for where they, you know, they talk about it, then they don't talk about it anymore. And I thought Bill Dudley's piece today was kind of a interesting because he was talking, it was all about forward guidance. And I'm not a great fan of forward guidance. I think it locks you in. And it's the Fed trying to control the market. And that's what they've been trying to do. I guess there was a speech given by Claudio Barro yesterday, it was a talk and he really ripped into them because what they've done is really destroy the market signaling mechanisms. And every time the market starts to signal, they get nervous. And what they called out the Fed for buying what 40 or the Treasury, $43 billion of, you know, because they were trying to smooth the markets. So I'm with Joseph. I would cut 50 basis points in June because send the message back to everybody else. Again, everybody's cutting. The Canadians have cut down. So everybody is running real yields of zero to maybe plus 25 basis points. In the U.S., I would probably say, I don't know what Joe, I would just say maybe we're over, let's say 1.25 using their numbers. It's too high, especially if you want a weaker dollar. And I think I'm in the camp that you should have a weaker dollar. I think it would assuage certain things. And if I'm a foreigner, I don't want to buy U.S. treasuries now, but if the dollar index went down to 85 or 90, that may be very more appealing to me. I don't have to, I won't do it with hedges and therefore, so, and the dollar has been too strong because of the carry trade. And I think the euro has been interesting because again, as Joseph talked about, what's going to go on in Europe, they're doing a lot of spending. When you got the Germans off the zero mark, and all of a sudden they're willing to put, you know, $850 billion of stimulus in, and others are certainly to follow. Yeah, European yields on the longer end have gone up, but the ECB keeps pushing them lower. So I'm in Joseph's camp. If they cut 100 basis points, do it quickly. Do not wait. You'll get the lower dollar. Will you impact the longer end? Maybe not, but that'll depend on what Congress and if these people actually grow up and really deal with the debt. You know, and I said it before when we were talking, I think the last podcast I did last week with Faber, you know, Joseph, they want to be good custodians of the public purse, but as American farmers, due to the stupid tariffs of Navarro and the way that they were orchestrated and put in going back to 2018, the farmers have really been hurt. And China never met its purchasing of U.S. agricultural products. So I'd be pushing at that rather than their first response, which is, oh, let's come up with a support package for the American farmers. Well, to me, that destroys your credibility as any type of real custodian of budgeting. If that's your first response, I would be hammering on the Chinese, hey, it's time for you to step up and here it is and start buying you rather than bailing out the farm or offering some type of relief, you know, to whoever. So there's so much here, but I'm with Joseph. I would cut rates. And this talk of, we're going to wait. For what?
Yeah, I have no idea. I think you have a good point where, you know, maybe if Trump would not talk about Powell so much, they might be more inclined to behave. Daryl Perkins has a really good saying that central banks are like teenage children, right? The more you tell them to do something, the less they're willing to do it. But one thing I think though is that, you know, next year Trump is going to get his Fed chair. He doesn't have to fire Powell. Powell's term is up, and then he gets to appoint someone. So, you know, that could be a big change in how policy is conducted. Now, the front runner right now, people say, is Kevin Walsh. I have no idea why that would be the case. The guy is like the biggest hawk ever. I think he wanted to hike after Lehman Brothers collapse as well. So
no.
maybe Trump will find that out. But, you know, if we're in a world where policy changes, all that is just everything is changing, right? You have the powers of the presidency, you know, being tested. You have institutions being challenged. And to be clear, this can be done because the public has less confidence in our legacy institutions. You know, what if you have a Fed that, because of changing populism and so forth, what if they, you know, what if inflation target goes to like into an inflation band, right? So let's say instead of 2%, let's do 1 to 3%, right? It's still centered around 2, but you know, that's a big change. And all these things that fundamentally undergird the markets and our way of thinking, I think are in a time of flux. And so I understand that if you are a 30-year bondholder and you're looking at that saying, you know, what does the future look like in 30 years? It can be quite different. So I can see that the curve steepening and Fed cuts, because this Fed, as far as I read them, cares much more about unemployment than inflation. And to be clear, inflation by their metrics are just a little bit above 2%, but they've consistently displayed, I think, a bit more of a dovish bias. So the moment we have unemployment rate go up a bit, I think they'll cut probably by a lot. And what that happens to the rest of the curve, I think we'll find out. But like you discussed earlier, Yara, I don't understand why anyone would want to hold long duration right now.
Yeah, too much certainty. Those are all great points. And this is, I agree with you. This, you know, we look at the four people Biden picked, right? They all come from basically the same place. I don't care what they put out there. This is definitely more concerned about unemployment. And we haven't seen, but it was interesting. They couldn't talk enough about the Sahm rule until the Sahm rule became relevant. And then they, well, maybe it doesn't mean all we even, you know, and even Claudia Sahm goes along with it because, well, you know, we have to wait and see. Well, you know, if you see a four, let's see, we get an unemployment number coming up in another 10 days or so. What if we get to 4.4? Do they panic at 4.4? Because the meeting will be in June. You know, and the JOLTS number to me is I don't buy that at all, because I've read some of those studies because of the way the electronic jobs board work. None of these companies take down the jobs because it's all about eyeballs. And if you have less jobs, you're going to get less eyeballs. So you may as well keep all these stale jobs up there. There was a study I may have it close to me. Oh, yeah, I can tell you. It was done by Rebecca Knight and Juliana Kaplan, and they a couple of years ago, and they called it into question. We've seen the jolts all. So that tells me that the market's far weaker than, because we're already down, I think, from 10.2 down to 7.1. And that's probably with a lot of other jobs there. So I think the jobs are much softer. The wage factor of it is much softer. The transportation industry is softening dramatically. I don't know where they came up with some of these numbers, because everybody you talk to, it's a lot less going on. And that's, you know, not counting the tariffs. Yeah, the housing is okay. For the big, it works, Toll Brothers. But for the small, it's not in really good shape. And we know one other thing, the commercial real estate market. If there is a fissure in the edifice, it's there right now, and stuff is coming due. And with rates on the long end going higher, their life's not becoming easier. Which is, again, what are you going to wait for? You're going to wait for the next crisis? get ahead of it, especially because the other banks are foaming the runway for you. I mean, that's the way that I see it.
No, I totally agree. I mean, we hear all these on the labor market, we hear all these anecdotal reports. These companies are firing their workforce, and we hear Doge just kind of liquidating, okay, firing lots of government employees. You know, that has to show up. And I mean, when I go on LinkedIn, all these people are looking for work and talking about their experiences and so forth. So it seems like the unemployment rate, at least it should be higher. And if not, definitely looks like it's trending towards that, trending upwards. So I think it makes sense for them to keep that in mind and be a bit more preemptive as they have been in the past.
Yeah, I'm with you. I was waiting to get your thoughts on that. I mean, I go read, and you pop up a lot of places, and Richard sends me. So I did see your recent. So I'm interested that you said that, because this digging in their heels, it's not going to work, and you're going to look and you put yourself in a. That's why the forward guidance puts you in a very difficult situation. Especially, you know, my first question would be, well, everybody around you is cutting. Why aren't you cutting? And the European inflation numbers are no different.
I have a question for you. So we haven't been cutting. Our rates are higher than others in real terms, as you mentioned before. The dollar is weakening a lot still, after all that. What do you think happens when we actually do get that big, let's say, miss on the employment data, and we start pricing in rapid cuts? I mean, you think the dollar will just really go? And if that's the case, you know,
I do. And Judd, can you, you know, we've seen 160 in euro dollar. We've seen, you know, yeah, we've seen the yen at 75 yen. I mean, we've seen levels that are so far different. And I'm not even using the dollar index. I'm just looking across. So I don't know what everybody screams about. And you know what? And then when I listen to Kudlow, who I don't have a lot of nice things to say, but when he always talks about, well, this is going to lead to inflation, king dollar. You know what? With the way the dollar is as a reserve currency, if there's going to be price increases from a lower dollar, it's a very slow process. It's not like tariffs. You don't just raise. The only time we saw that, I would probably argue, is 1973. That that OPEC used the Yom Kippur War to raise energy prices dramatically. But that, you know, if you ask me, that was in response to a weakening dollar, because especially Saudi Arabia and Kuwait, and they were, when the U.S. went off the gold exchange standard in 71, August of 71, and then they devalued again in 73, who was being left holding the bag? The largest holders of dollars, which were the OPEC countries, because of all the oil they were selling. So that was as much a way to reprice the commodity that they were selling. And, you know, they did it good. And then it worked greatly to their advantage, because they were running up, you know, we get the birth of the euro dollar market out of there and everything else that took place. So I'm not a believer that you're going to see price rises. If you use the dollar as the instrument to help correct some of the trade imbalances in the world, I think that's a much more effective way. It takes a while longer, but it doesn't disrupt. But this administration has historically been shown, and I'm not opposed to disrupting. You know, there are times that you really have to hit people in the head with a 2x4. Is this the time? I don't know, but I'm not. You know, I haven't been the one displaced by the globalization. I would say the arbitrage of international capital arbitraging labor wages. That's what it's been. So I haven't been displaced. I've been able to actually do very well with it. But is that worthy of the 2x4 right now? I don't know. I don't think so. I think if the dollar were to drop 15% to 20%. I don't think it's all that important, by the way. Yeah, some people would get hurt, but I think you would go a long way to affecting some of the changes that you're looking for, and it wouldn't be as dramatic on the price side as you would think. In fact, what we've seen historically, Japanese corporations ate that. They were very good at eating it to maintain market share. The Chinese know how to do that too. And even the South Koreans, they know how to protect their market share. And that leads to, you know, rushing to raise prices as dramatically. So,
no, you're exactly right. Especially since, like, because the dollar is reserve currency, everything's priced in dollars anyway. So,
right.
Your dollar weakens. Your dollar price. There's some good research from the IMF about the dollar pricing system. They don't actually change the dollar prices that often. Maybe, you know, over a year or two. And so even with your dollar weakens, you know, that what you actually pay, it's still priced in dollars.
It's a great point. Yeah, thanks for including, because that's right. And we've seen that. So yeah, again, you know, and I'm kind of surprised that Bessent hasn't been more, although I think he did gain control and we saw him really best and outmaneuver Navarro, because I think Trump let Navarro talk until the bond market started collapsing and Bessent said, okay, is this what you want? Because my criticism of Navarro is in his academic role that he sees things as he sees all outcomes as linear. And I think if I'm sitting here talking with you, Joseph, and if I had Scott Bessent sitting here in the other screen, these are far from linear outcomes.
Great. Yeah, Ira was just wondering if it's okay on time to ask one more question.
One more. Yeah, I got it.
Okay. Yeah, Joseph, just wondering your thoughts on, given all this and the capital flight, where do you see capital going to? Is it going into gold or East Asian currencies, markets there? Or we talked about Europe as well. Your thoughts there?
Yeah, so one thing that I noticed really clearly last month was that everything sold off. The only thing that went up was gold. And so I think that there is more of a diversification effort into gold. And the gold market is very small relative to everything else in the world. So that seems to be a really shining area there. But another thing to note is that, you know, when prices go down, capital just goes poof, right? So let's say you have $100 in NVIDIA stock and NVIDIA price goes down, you know, that kind of goes poof. So, you know, when you have these movements, some of it is just capital evaporating. But looking across the world, it seems like foreign equity markets, say, Europe are outperforming, say Latin America, are doing pretty well. So I think it's part of it is just foreign investors rebalancing a bit, not so overweight the US and just putting a bit more elsewhere. So I think it can go just all over the world. The biggest, I think, beneficiary is gold, simply because it's a small market. Everyone just adding a little makes the market go up a lot.
Mm-hmm. And quickly, Ira, your final thoughts.
No, yeah. Joseph, everything that Joseph says, I can't agree. Yeah. You know, and the concept of American exceptionalism, if it's only fiscal stimulus, that's not great exceptionalism. And I would tell people, go read and go watch the work of John Cochrane, because John Cochrane has written great stuff on fiscal and how much of this has been the fiscal end. And I'll tell you what, he's gone a little quiet here. Is Olivier Blanchard, who did a really magnificent study on the multiplier effect of fiscal stimulus versus monetary stimulus. And I mean, that's been the exceptionalism. And I think Joseph's point, Europe, and as we've talked about this ad nauseum already, but you see other parts of the world, because they're now going full bore on fiscal stimulus, America's not so exceptional anymore. In fact, as what's his name from Lombard Street, as they wrote back into the bill from the China shop, this is now the bill from the fiscal stimulus shop that's coming due to the United States. And it's not good. It's not good. The bill has just arrived at the table. And for all the COVID and all the QE, and the Fed is now negative, you know, is running big negative numbers. So it's enormous. I'd love to do another one with Joe. We got stuff, and I'd like to come back in June and let's see what the Fed does. But I can't agree with Joseph more. I think he's right on target, and this has been great. Thank you.
Yeah, great. And Joseph, your website and Substack, where our listeners and viewers can learn more about your work.
Well, first off, thanks so much for inviting me. And it's a pleasure to chat with you again. Always learn so much on this show. And thanks, Jude, for these great charts. So if you guys are interested, my website is fedguy.com. I write a weekly newsletter about what's happening in the markets to help you better understand and make decisions. Also have a YouTube channel called Joseph Wang, where I talk about weekly market developments as well. All right, guys. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Joseph,
be well. Judd.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Right. Talk to you guys next time.
Bye.
Yeah.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.